This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his work reporting from Zimbabwe, Andrew Meldrum investigated and chronicled corruption, tyranny, massacres, and other human rights abuses under the regime of President Robert Mugabe. Over the past year and a half, Meldrum had been harassed by the government, accused of being a liar, arrested, and briefly jailed. He was tried and acquitted. Last month, he was thrown out of the country. He had been the last foreign correspondent allowed to remain. The others had already been deported after the enactment of new press laws that restricted foreign journalists, required journalists to be licensed by the government, and made it illegal to criticize the president. Mugabe's crackdown on the free press parallels its suppression of the opposition party and its co-optation of the judicial system. Meldrum is an American-born reporter who has lived in and reported from Zimbabwe for the past 23 years. He writes for the London newspaper, The Guardian. He says that in the 80s, it was thrilling to report on a newly independent Zimbabwe, but that changed as President Mugabe changed. Well, first of all, Andrew, I'm glad to hear that you're safe. How were you abducted and expelled from the country?
Yes, well, that's the correct terminology. Many people have said I was deported, and my lawyer tells me that I was not deported because deported is a legal procedure. And she said everything about what happened to me was illegal. And it's a long story. On May 7th, some security agents, one of whom identified himself as a immigration official, came to our house after dark. I was not at home. My wife answered and told them I wasn't there. They said they would wait until I came home. They refused to show any identification papers. They had four vehicles, including a large van with blacked-out windows. My lawyer came. They once again refused to show any identification papers, and they wouldn't say why they wanted to talk to me. And so my wife and lawyer reached me on my cell phone and advised me not to come home. They at that time felt that they wanted to take me away and throw me out of the country at that time. Or, even worse, they were afraid that they might want to abduct me and rough me up, which is what has happened to many Zimbabweans in recent months. So for about 10 days, I was actually not going home, not staying, sleeping at home. My lawyer did go into immigration. They said, yes, they wanted to see me, but they would not say what it was about. And so she and I went into immigration together. They asked me a few very, very basic questions, and they then, which they could have found the answers on my residence permit. Then they seized my passport and my residence permit, and when we left, we went back a couple days later, and at that time, they issued me with deportation orders. They declared me a prohibited immigrant, saying I was undesirable in the country. My lawyer went for a court order to say that this was illegal, which she did get. But as we were walking out, I was surrounded by six or seven police officers, and when I was trying to speak to the assembled press, I was forcibly kicked, punched, pushed, and just at one point lifted up and taken away, put into a car that then sped away. When I was in the car, the plainclothes security officers around me put a jacket over my head and held it around my neck so that it was a hood, which I could not see out of. And they drove me around for about, and when they put the hood on, they thumped me on the back and they said, the time for games is over. And then they drove me around for about 40 minutes, I would say. It was very disorienting. I couldn't tell exactly where they took me, but I was hoping they would take me directly to the airport, but they did not. We went on to a kind of gravel or dirt road, and my heart sank at that point.
Andrew, at this point, were you preparing yourself for torture? Because that has happened to people in Zimbabwe, people you've interviewed.
That's exactly. I was mentally preparing myself for that kind of treatment to me. People that I've interviewed have been taken away on dirt roads with a hood over their head, have been taken to rural police stations, taken into the basement, and have spent 2 days being beaten, unconscious, being electric shocked to the point of convulsions. And I was afraid that that was what was going to happen to me. What I did was I thought, these men are bullies, and I don't want them to know that I'm afraid. And I started wiping my sweaty hands on my pants. And I put my shoulders back and I took a deep breath. And I thought, I don't want them to have the satisfaction of knowing that I'm frightened. And I tried to just, I started thinking about the crunch of bones and the, you know, kind of singeing of electricity. And I thought, don't think about that. You're frightening yourself. And so then happily, at just about that point, when I was just kind of mentally preparing myself, the car pulled back onto a tarred road and we started speeding ahead. And I could just make out the faint outline of the Independence Arch, which is right before the entrance to the airport. And I was delighted because I realized we were getting to the airport and they were just trying to frighten me.
So you got to the airport, they put you on a plane, and you went to London?
Not quite that simple. I was actually taken into the basement of the airport and held in a small room, a little cubicle, for 10 hours. And actually, what I found out later was happening at that time. I was still a bit afraid that they would come back after dark and you know, beat me up in the basement of the airport. But actually, what was happening was my lawyer had won a court order saying that this was illegal. She had taken it to the airport, and the government had tried to put me on a South African Airways flight to Johannesburg, but South African Airways refused, saying that this is illegal, and we cannot take somebody in an illegal action like this. So the government had to wait until there was a night flight going to London by Air Zimbabwe. And they did put me, they had to forcibly put me on it. They forcibly kept my lawyer from getting to me and giving me the court order. And they were informed both by my lawyer and by me that this was illegal, and they all just said, "There's, you know, we're not obeying any court order, we are just doing this."
During the 10 days that you didn't go home because you knew that they were looking for you, that the police were looking for you, why didn't you try to sneak out of the country?
I was very firm about this. If I had left the country, I would have been running away, and it would have given the government the opportunity to say, you see, he had something to hide. He was running away. And although I was not sleeping at home, I made a point of going to a few different public engagements, diplomatic receptions and press conferences, and then I would leave so that I could tell people, I'm not in hiding. I am here. I'm trying to do my work as best I can, and I'm not running away from anything. I'm just waiting for my lawyer to sort things out so I can meet with people officially who will give me identification as to who they are and can tell me what it is they want to speak to me about.
You were the last foreign correspondent in Zimbabwe. How were you able to stay that long?
Yes, I'm the last foreigner who was able to report on Zimbabwe. There are several Zimbabwean journalists who write for the foreign media, but yes, I was the last foreign journalist in Zimbabwe. I was lucky in that I had a permanent residence permit, a permit of permanent residence, which I received about 8 or 9 years ago. I've been living in Zimbabwe for 23 years, at that time it didn't seem like there was anything too dangerous to the government for giving me that residence permit. And I had purchased my home in Harare and had settled in there, and I was very much a fixture on the local scene. And so I was able to continue working, and as things got tougher and hotter, I continued doing my work. And I'd like to point out, I was not the only person writing my, the stories, which focused on human rights abuses, on the repression of the press, on the breakdown of the rule of law, on the collapse of the Zimbabwean economy. Those are not things that I was the only journalist writing about. There are many fine and committed journalists, both for the local press and for the foreign press, who write about the very same issues.
So because you had this valid residence permit, there was a court order that said you had a constitutional right to stay in the country, even though most of the foreign press had been expelled.
That's correct. In fact, this was not the first time. As you know, a year ago, in May of 2002, I was put in jail briefly for 33 hours. The government pressed criminal charges against me. I was put on trial for 2 months. I was acquitted, and moments after I was acquitted, the government then tried to deport me at that time. My lawyer insisted that I had every legal right to be in the country, and we went to the court, back to the courts, and they ruled, yes, that I had the constitutional right to stay in the country. And so then I continued working for another year, but I was harassed over that period. There were numerous articles written about me in the state press, suggesting that, well, charging that I was a spy for the U.S. government, a spy for a British government, a liar, a cheat. They said just about everything except that I beat my dogs.
Why was it so important to the Zimbabwe government and to President Robert Mugabe to expel foreign reporters from the country?
Well, I think the government is more and more threatened. The collapse of the economy has become so acute that it's creating great problems. The government is becoming more desperate, and I think it's a classic case of shooting the messenger, or in my case, deporting the messenger, because they don't like the message. And that message is that the government is very unpopular, that the government has lost any ability to come up with solutions for the country's pressing problems.
What were some of the stories that you had recently covered that you knew would make the government of Robert Mugabe very angry?
Political manipulation of food aid, so that Zimbabwe currently has a dire shortage of food, a famine that is affecting more than half of the country's 12 million people. And those people are only getting by because of international food aid. And I had interviewed many people that told how they were denied food aid because they were identified as being supporters of the opposition party. That's one story. Torture by police. I interviewed members of parliament, lawyers, other prominent citizens who were tortured, including an 18-year-old boy. Who were tortured with electric shock treatment, with beatings at the hands of police in police stations. And this was confirmed by medical evidence that was medical examinations that were done the moment they were released from police custody. Also I wrote about the economic collapse. There is inflation of 270%. There is unemployment of more than 70%. And there's a shortage of gasoline, of electricity, there's even a shortage of banknotes, of Zimbabwe currency notes. You can't. A worker last week who went to the bank could not get paid his full paycheck. He would only get about 20% of the paycheck. And this is with inflation going sky high, with shortages of food, and these workers need to buy food for their families. So those are just some of the stories.
Were the people who you interviewed punished for talking with you?
I was careful, actually, for the past year or more. When I interview people, unless they are public figures who stand up and say, you know, I want to be counted as saying this, other people, I would change their names, and I would tell the reader in the story that the names have been changed to protect people from retribution. Because, some journalists would change the names without flagging it in the story, but then I was worried that there might be somebody who had that name, and then they would get punished. So I was pretty careful to do that, and I don't know of anybody that I interviewed that has suffered anything. But it, particularly when I went into the rural areas, I was very aware that that was a danger for them.
What were some of the other government attacks against the press in recent months?
Well, in recent months, there have been more than 30, in the past year, there have been more than 30 journalists and editors who have been arrested and jailed, and all held, I might add, under the same charges that I was, which is the abuse of journalistic privilege by publishing a falsehood. And I'm happy to say that after my acquittal, only two of the other cases came to trial, and those were also acquitted. So, in other words, none of the journalists who were arrested were convicted of that crime, which is punishable by a jail sentence of up to 2 years. And I'm very pleased because I think that my stubbornness to stay on and stand trial, and the great and brilliant work of my lawyer, Beatrice Mtetwa, to get my acquittal, helped the whole press stand firm, and it made the government have to back down because they thought that they could get us all convicted.
This week is a week of protest in Zimbabwe, a week that was organized by the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai. What's going on this week in Zimbabwe?
Well, there's a national strike which has been extremely effective in closing down all industrial and commercial activity. The country has virtually ground to a halt, and it's for 5 days. And it comes hot on the heels of a two-day national strike in March and a three-day national strike in April. So this is a continual building of pressure against the government. There is also, this time, there are public demonstrations. They're very small scale, but they do keep on cropping up, and they're being met with very heavy repression from the government by armed police, by army tanks that are patrolling the streets of the town, of the city center and of the outlying townships, by tear gas, by arrests, by beatings. I just had word that a hospital that was treating victims of state violence has been raided, attacked by riot police. You know, there is very heavy government repression, but I think what is significant is that there are people, it may only be a few thousand people, but they are risking their safety to stand up and say, we are fed up with this government and we want to see democracy restored.
What are some of the things that the Mugabe government has done that has most alienated the people of Zimbabwe?
They've allowed the economy to get completely run down. Zimbabwe used to have one of the strongest economies in Africa, and the people enjoyed one of the best standards of living. And today, as I've told you, half the people are on international food aid. The other half are grappling with inflation, which is just out of control. The currency has become so worthless. We pay bills in what we call bricks of, you know, wads of $500 notes. And, you know, you have to have several of the bricks in order to get a week's worth of groceries. And it is the economic degradation of the country that is really getting people angry. A man or a woman with a job cannot afford to take public transport. And so often I have very good friends who get up at before 4 o'clock in the morning in order to hike their way into work by 8 o'clock, and then they hike their way back and they only get home after 9 or 10 o'clock at night. It is this kind of suffering as a result of the economic collapse of the country that I think is driving the political situation.
President Mugabe has also run this program confiscating farmland from white farmers. What was his motivation for doing that, and what has the outcome of the program been?
Well, I believe that he had a very cynical aim by seizing the white farms, and he had run out of policies, and he had also run out of popularity in the year 2000, and he realized he had to do something, and so he took the step to make a kind of big grandstand of grabbing the farms owned by whites and saying that they would turn them over to poor blacks. And he used that very much as a smokescreen. He wants to be seen as the great African leader who is standing up against the whites, who is standing up against the colonial power Britain, and shaking his fist at them and telling them where to go. And he is using that as a facade to hide the fact that he is actually repressing and using violence to put down a legal opposition party that is made up overwhelmingly of black Zimbabweans. And he doesn't want the world to see that. He wants the world to see him as the African leader who is standing up to whites and the former colonialist power.
What has he done with the white land that he confiscated?
Well, unfortunately, the greatest tragedy is that that land that has been confiscated is not being productively farmed. A great deal of that land was not turned over to poor black farmers, as he had promised. Instead, it was turned over to rich blacks who are close to him, his generals, his generals' wives, cabinet ministers, his own wife, his sister, many other people who are tied in with the government got the biggest and nicest farms. The farms that were turned over to poor blacks were portioned or parceled up into tiny little plots, and poor black farmers were just dumped on those areas without any economic support, without any special training, and they just continued as they had been before, as subsistence farmers. And what Zimbabwe does not need is more subsistence farming. What it needs is more productive farming. And it's no surprise that when all this disruption to a once healthy, productive agricultural land, now the country that used to be called the breadbasket of Africa is subsisting on international food handouts.
Three African leaders recently tried to convince Robert Mugabe to step down from the presidency. This was the presidents of Nigeria, South Africa, and Malawi. What was Mugabe's response?
Mugabe's response publicly was to try and say that they came to help him negotiate with Britain over the disagreements between Britain and Zimbabwe on the land issue that we just talked about. In fact, he was publicly contradicted by those presidents who said, no, we came to try and encourage negotiations between Robert Mugabe and the opposition. So he was publicly contradicted by these leaders, and they put pressure on him. They said, well, we want you to come to the negotiation table. So far, Mr. Mugabe has not made any steps in that direction, but I do believe that the pressure is building, and he won't be able to avoid having to negotiate a peaceful transition to democracy in Zimbabwe.
It sounds like President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa is in a slightly difficult spot because Zimbabwe and Robert Mugabe were very supportive of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, and a lot of anti-apartheid leaders took safe haven in Zimbabwe when it was unsafe for them to operate from South Africa. So I think they feel like it's awkward for them now to ask Mugabe to step aside.
It is awkward for them, but on the other hand, for them to continue to watch the economy of their largest trading partner, which is what Zimbabwe is, and to see the economy of their largest trading partner decline so much is hurting their own economy. To see living standards and the rule of law erode in their neighbor country so that they have 2 million illegal immigrants from Zimbabwe that are seeking jobs and seeking safety in South Africa, that is creating a problem for South Africa as well. They would like to overlook all these problems because, as you say, Zimbabwe is a fellow liberation movement, is run by a party that's a fellow liberation movement that did give support to them during the anti-apartheid struggle. But they have had to draw a line and say, well, they helped us then, but in fact what they're doing now is something that we can't agree with. They're oppressing their own people in much the same way that black South Africans were oppressed under apartheid, that black Zimbabweans were oppressed by Rhodesia. The Mugabe government is using the very same laws and the very same tactics that the Rhodesian government used to suppress African nationalism back in the 60s and 70s in Zimbabwe. So they are, yes, put in an awkward position, but on the other hand, it's gone so far now that I believe they really must own up to the fact that they can't continue to support the Mugabe regime.
If Robert Mugabe stepped down and removed himself from power, or if he was overthrown from power, would you want to move back to Zimbabwe?
Oh, certainly. But you know, let me say, I believe that a positive outcome for Zimbabwe is really not very far away. I believe that the pressures are mounting on Robert Mugabe and his regime when the government cannot do the very things that a government is supposed to do, which is to provide, let's say, enough currency so that people can have ordinary transactions, cannot provide the rule of law so business can go on as normal, cannot provide enough gasoline so that cars, buses, trucks can carry out ordinary daily economic activities. When a government fails to do all those things, it's not very long before it has to give up. And the pressure is mounting both domestically and regionally amongst African leaders on Robert Mugabe, and I don't think it's very long before he must agree to a negotiated, peaceful transition to free and fair elections. But I have to say, time is running out. If that is not done in a few months or within a year, I would say the people's anger will grow to the extent that then you will see a violent overthrow of Mugabe, and that is not good for the country. What Zimbabwe desperately needs is to see the power of democracy, the power of a ballot to change a government that the people are unhappy with. And that would be an important historic precedent for Zimbabwe, but also for the rest of Africa.
But, of course, elections have been kind of rigged by Mugabe, so overthrowing him by ballot seems kind of difficult.
Well, that's why it has to be negotiated, because you have to set ground rules for the elections so that it's not left in, you know, that the party who's running for election also runs all the balloting, all the counting, which is what we saw in the past elections. They were so blatantly rigged, and there was such a large amount of violence that no independent observer agreed that those were free and fair elections. And the Commonwealth, which is the organization of 54 former British colonies, which includes many African countries, many Asian countries like India and Pakistan, many Caribbean countries, so it wasn't an all-white organization by any means. The Commonwealth agreed that both the parliamentary elections in 2000 and also the presidential elections in 2002 were not free and fair, and therefore were not valid or legitimate. What I'm talking about is elections that are run under basic international standards that would be free and fair. And I can tell you, if only that would happen in Zimbabwe, it would resolve the country's problems very, very quickly.
Andrew, the Zimbabwe government abducted and expelled you. What about your wife? Where is she?
She remains in Zimbabwe at the moment. She does not appear to be a target in any way. She's carrying on at our home with our dogs, and she has her work to do in the health field. And at the moment, touch wood, everything seems to be going well. We won't be apart for very long. We're still trying to sort out what we're going to do.
Is she from Zimbabwe?
No, she's from California, actually.
So she's in the same position as you are in terms of being
That's right.
Foreign.
That's right. She's a foreigner, but she has a residence permit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you plan on doing if you can't get back to Zimbabwe in the near future?
Well, then I intend to be in South Africa, I think, and to cover Zimbabwe from South Africa, and to also cover other countries in the region, because Zimbabwe doesn't stand alone. The surrounding countries, Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia, Angola, and Namibia, and South Africa, they all have similar histories to Zimbabwe, and they're all going through similar issues at different times and in different ways. So it's very interesting to cover those and to have an understanding of all of them. So that's what I would like to do. I also have been inspired by your questions and by this experience, and I think I have a good story to tell, and I would like to write a book about it.
Andrew, it seems that whenever I talk to you, it's because, you know, your life is in crisis. You know, you've been you're being tried by the Zimbabwe government, or expelled by the Zimbabwe government, or being threatened by the government. Is that your whole life? I mean, that's the part we always present on Fresh Air. What's the rest of your life like?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because actually I enjoy life, and I'm actually a fun-loving guy, and I've stayed in Zimbabwe not just because it's a struggle I'm committed to, but because it's a beautiful country and it has a gorgeous climate, and I have lots of friends there, and we have we have a great time. There's good music, and really it's I enjoy life, It's not all serious, that's all I'd like. Oh, and for instance, my lawyer, she was fantastic, she was brave, she was brilliant in court, she was committed, but also the best part for me was she was so funny, and we could crack a joke even as I was being dragged away by the police, and it just made it almost fun.
Almost.
Almost, yeah.
Okay. Well, so glad that you're well. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Andrew Meldrum writes for the London newspaper The Guardian. He was expelled from Zimbabwe last month after reporting from the country for 23 years.